Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00088. Recorded on July 11, 2025. Production location, Post-Harlan, Texas. Texas Red, Part 1, Chapter 88.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Okay. Welcome back to Post-Harlan Monologics. I'm your host, Maverick 88. And when I was a little kid, right? In fact, it happened in 1969. I was 2 years old and my brother was 1 year old. And that year, a board game was released. Now, here's the thing about board games. If you are a boomer, Gen X, you grew up in a time, half a Gen X anyway, you grew up in a time where there was no such thing as video games, okay? No such thing. But we had board games, right? Board games, you know what board games are. I don't have to explain that, do I have to? You literally had a game, you opened up a board, and the board had graphics on it, and there was a game with rules and pieces and all that, and there was all kinds of them, right? And everywhere you go, so just like now, you know, you go to somebody's house, they've got a video game console, and they got a certain selection of video games that you could play. And nobody has everything, you know, and some people have more than other people. But that's how it was back then, the early 70s and the mid-70s. You didn't have video games, you know. You had, like, the very bare-bones initial attempts at console games that plugged into television sets. Odyssey, Pong, right, for example. Which we had, eventually, into the late 70s. But in the early 70s... nobody had anything like that. Very few. I mean, very few people had it. And if you did, it was incredibly boring, right? Literally, like watching ping pong, real slow, back and forth. Not very much fun. But everybody had board games, and wherever, whatever house you go to, whether they had kids or not, everybody had board games. Now, some board games are oriented towards adults. Some board games are oriented towards, you know, little toddlers and stuff, and then there's all kinds of stages of variation in between. So you go visit one house, and they would have a selection of board games. Your own house, of course, would have your own selection, another house would have another. So as kids, you'd go, you had sleepovers, or you'd go play in the afternoon, it'd be a rainy day, you'd break out the board games. A board game was released in 1969, it was called Ants in the Pants, right? Like, certain people, we didn't have it. We didn't have Ants in the Pans in our house, that I recall. But other kids did. And Ants in the Pants was basically a ripoff of Tiddlywinks, if you know what Tiddlywinks is. Right? Tiddlywinks is the old English game. I think it was developed, in the 1800s in the pubs in England. I think a tiddly or a tiddlywink is actually a reference to, well, how's it, like an unlicensed pub, right? Or just, I don't know, low-class, substandard pub, something like that. But they started playing this game. And you had little discs, and you know, you do use one disc to press against another disc on a table, and the edge of it would force the second disc to kind of pop, and you try to pop it and land it, you know, in a certain zone, or you would try to cover over your competition's tiddlywink so that they couldn't pop theirs, right? So there was limited strategy. Anybody could play it, and of course, you know, kids played it. Everybody played tiddlywinks when we were little kids, you know. Ants in the Pants was a version of that. Instead of a wink, instead of a little round disc that you would pop, you had these ants. It had, you know, like different colors for different players. In the center of it, the zone where you wanted to land your ants, your tiddlywink, was just like this plastic set of like overalls, you know, or blue jeans for a fat person, like a portly belly. You know, it was kind of like a bowl, but it was meant to be denim. And then it had like suspenders that went across the top that were kind of like an impedance to your shot. What you would do, you press like the ass end of the plastic ant down to the surface of your table or whatever, and it had some kind of springing mechanism in there that would cause the ant to pop up. And we would aim it and try to get enough force to make it land inside these blue jeans. And when you, I don't know, I don't remember if it was a time thing or if you're just the first one to run out of ants wins, but that was Ants in the Pants. That was the game, right? Bear with me. I say that for a reason. I'm going to talk about ants. See, I grew up in New Jersey, and in New Jersey, you know, we would play with actual real ants and never have a problem with it. Won't quite like it is down south, and I'll get into that momentarily. But yeah, we would just sit on a curb on a street, bored little kids, you know, we might be 4 or 5 years old, and you just sit there, and you got like a dirty piece of you know, distressed lawn lining the streets next to the sidewalk, if there was even a little piece of distressed lawn at all. And you would just have dirt, and in the dirt you'd have holes, and in the holes was an ant nest, right? Ants would come out and you'd see them. We had basically two different kinds, really three. You know, you had a black ant, you had a red ant, and then you had a black ant with wings, which I don't know what they were. I think we would refer to them as like carpenter ants, but I don't even know if that's true. I don't think all carpenter ants have wings, but there was a winged black ant, right? Those were the basic three that we dealt with, and none of them were a problem. They would just be around, they'd crawl on you, and you'd watch them, or you'd mess with them, or you'd smear them and kill them, or you'd flick them off. But you never had to worry about them. My little kids could just sit there and play, and the ants were harmless, and that's how it was. Even the red ants, like, you know, the red ants down south, they're fire ants, right? And they're dangerous, even deadly. But up north, that wasn't the case. They were just simply ants of a different color, and they meant no harm to nobody, right? But here in Texas, in fact, the entire south, you got fire ants. Your red ants down here are a menace, and they're everywhere, right? And they get worse in the heat of the summer. They get a lot more aggressive. They spread and move a lot more active. But they're around all year long, and you've got to be aware of them continually. But they definitely get worse. Like this time, we're talking July into August, you know, late June, early September. You really got to be paying attention. They're kind of everywhere. They've got humongous nests. They run around in the grass. You got nests that you can't see because they're under grass. You step right on them. You stand there. You have no idea that they're coming up your legs. And I'll get into that. There's a reason I'm talking about these dang things. There's a reason I bring up Ants in the Pants. But these things are, it's not just a Texas thing. It's a whole South thing, right? You got Texas red ants or fire ants. Fire ants are really ants in the whole South. There are other types of ants around, but the ones you almost always see are the ones that you don't want to see. Just the way it is. Really bad in Texas. But my first encounter then was actually my first encounter down south. on a more or less permanent basis, not just passing through, not just vacationing right quick. I was in Marine Corps, and I was in basic training in a place called Parris Island, South Carolina, right on the coast. And there was a day where we were all run out as a platoon, right? When I say we, it was a whole platoon. And we were doing the, what they call the gas chamber, right? There's gas chambers, this green vomit-inducing gas was poured out onto us, and we're all locked in this cinder block room, right? This concrete building, basically, just this block. One door in, one door out. There's some kind of system that emitted gas from the middle of it, and the gas was this green vomit-inducing gas. And the idea was that we were learning how to don a gas mask, operate it properly, get it on safely and thoroughly in a stressful condition. And of course, you know, it sucked. It wasn't about having a good time at all. It got so dense in the green, you know, your eyes burned a little bit, you're huffing this vomit inducing stuff, so you're trying to like contain yourself. You can't really see. We were all formed against the walls into a square, and then we were to like put one hand on the shoulder of the guy in front of us, and everybody just start walking forward, and you just kind of follow along. And as you go, they tell you to take your mask off, put your mask on, take the mask off, and, you know, but you were forced to huff this stuff at one point or another, you know, a couple of points, and then get the mask on and clear it out. Then eventually, when you were done, your line would slowly go out the door, out the side door, and everybody would go out into the parking lot. Now, we had an especially rough time, the squad that I was in, right? Because we had one guy, he was a soul brother from Detroit. I remember his name, but I'm not going to say it here. He lost his shit. He freaked out. He freaked out, and he just started spazzing, running around the room. He found the door, and he tried to open the door and go at it, and he couldn't get out because drill instructor was standing on the other side barricading the door just in case something like this happened, right? So this dude just bashes at the door until he blows the door open and sends the drill instructor flying, you know, and his smoky hat went flying off his head. And oh boy, was he pissed off, right? You don't humiliate these guys. And we all had to pay for what this asshole did. That's the way it works in a Marine Corps. You know, one person messes up and everybody pays. And the way we were paying was by doing push-ups. So we got put out on a sand lot, right? You know, before we get out to there, everybody comes out. And then because it was vomit-inducing gas that we were huffing, people were puking all over the place, right? Me, the alcoholic that I was, I had a stomach of steel. I went out, I hocked a loogie, and I was good to go. It didn't bother me like it bothered everybody else. Burned the eyes a little bit. You know, you had to kind of rub some of that out of your eyes to be able to just kind of, you know, blink a couple of times and see right. But I was good. In fact, out of the entire squad of people that was in there, it was me and some other guy, really didn't have that much of a problem with it. But everybody else was zooling all over the place, drooling and zooling. It was quite the sight, right, on this parking lot. Then off to the back side of the building, there was just kind of a little grass field, a little meadow. And because we were on a coast, you know, your soil base was all sand. So we got run out there, and the pissed off drill instructor is barking at us to do push-ups. So we're all standing there in our formation, and we're told down to the ground and start doing push-ups, right? Well, I landed on the ground, and in between my thumb and forefinger on my left hand, there was this hole about the size of a silver dollar, which is a little bit bigger than the size of a half dollar, which is bigger than the size of a quarter for all you people that are not familiar, because they don't really circulate these things anymore. And I'm thinking snake. I'm thinking a snake hole. And I'm like, that is a bad place to be. But I just did what I was told, because that's what you did in the military. You just did what you were told pretty much, and that's how you got through. So down one, down two, we're doing push-ups. And then all of a sudden, I just see this band of ants come out, and it gets onto my hand. And before I can even contemplate what's going on, I mean, it happened very quickly. The guy in front of me started freaking out, right? He was doing push-ups in front of me. He just got up and he started dancing around like ants in the pants, right? The idea ants in the pants, it's an expression of somebody who's kind of fidgety, nervous, anxious, right? You get ants in the pants and you feel them crawling around, you start kind of shuffling and skittering. And but this guy was doing that, and then he just started spazzing completely because he was getting stung and bit by these things. They were fire ants, right? So he's dancing around and he's smacking his legs and he's howling out. Drill instructors, plural, are freaking out because you don't do that. You just stay in your formation. And I did, right? Now, I'm looking at these ants, and they went across my hand. They're going up my arm. I don't see what's happening on the rest of the ground around me, but I'm right on top of the nest as well as that other guy, right? But I'm there doing my push-ups, and I'm getting stung, and I'm getting bit, and I'm just dealing with it. And this guy's freaking out, and everybody's looking at him. But the guy who was next to me and the guy who was behind me, they saw that I was getting covered in these things. I was still doing push-ups, right? And they come running over to me, and the drill instructors are freaking out now because everybody is, like, coming out of formation. Guys are getting on top of me and smacking the shit out of me, right? They're just trying to do everything they can to kill these ants, get them off of me. They're doing push-ups. I had no idea. I knew what was going on. I didn't really know how serious it all was. And so they were freaking out, and I was not. And finally, I get to standing up, and the drill, they're pulling my clothes off of me, right? Ripping my pants off, my shirt. Drill instructor is losing his mind because nobody's listening to him anymore at this point. And, he's coming over, and I'm bit up pretty good. You could see it. I mean, you don't really see it right away, and you don't get all itchy right away. And I didn't really have a problem with it right away. A few hours later, it all started to come to the surface. We got back to our barracks, right? We were run through showers, and I come out, and I'm all pocked up with these things. And there was like three or four guys came around me, and they just started counting. You know, one would get a body part, like an arm. Another one would get a leg, and they're looking at my back. They counted 256 bites on me, right? And it happened all like in a minute. It was just that quick. I might have had some lingering ones that were caught up in my shirt and my pants throughout the day. But I was bit up good. I was bit up good, and I ended up getting the day off the next day. I got sent down to the sick bay, and I got, a nurse covered me up with calamine lotion, what you get for poison ivy. That's what they did for it that day. It wasn't really all that helpful. Didn't really all much matter. I was back at work the following day, itchy or not, hurting or not, didn't matter, right? Didn't matter to them. And that was my first experience with fire ants. Again, I didn't think much of it. I had seen television shows when I was little, about life down south and, out in the fields. You'd get these massive fire ant mounds that were, like, bigger than a grown person. And, like, a cow would walk up to it, bump into it, and all of a sudden all these ants would run out, and they would cover the cow, and they would take the cow down, and they would eat it and leave nothing but the bones, Horror stories about it. And like, this sort of thing can actually happen. You get so poisoned by these things, you lose consciousness, and you drop out. Now you're just like a carcass on the ground, and the ants will just start picking at you and eating you, and they will. Throw a piece of fried chicken on the ground here in Texas. Just throw it out in the middle of a parking lot somewhere and wait. They'll come out from everywhere, and they will sit on it for 3 days until every little morsel of meat is gone and there's nothing but the bone. Just a dry bone laying there, right? They're really incredible. They act as one in force, right? You kill one, right? You disturb a nest, they come out at you. You put your foot down and smear a couple of them on the ground, they release some kind of chemical, some kind of pheromone or something like that, and they smell it on you, and they recognize by that means that you are the killer, you are the threat, you are the problem, and they'll just do a beeline for you. And no matter where you go, they come after. And if there's other people standing in the way, they will go right past them. I did this. I was teaching a kid, a former stepson of mine, back in the day. I used to live in Wiley. We had a backyard. There was an old garden that we were tearing out of there and redoing and pulling all these planks out that the previous homeowners left in there, all this PVC they had for irrigation and stuff. It's all cracked up, corroded, busted up, right? And pulled out this one piece, and all of a sudden all these fire ants come running out of it, right? All these fire ants come running out, and I see him, and I took the opportunity, because it's the kind of guy I am, to teach this kid about fire ants, right? So he's looking at them and all, and I'm like, you got to stay away from them, right? Now I'm going to show you. Watch how these things act. And I went over to where they were. They were coming up over a plank, looking for where the problem was coming from, and I was able to smush them on the plank, right? So I smushed them out, got that pheromone or whatever the hell it is, that scent onto the bottom of my shoe. And then I left the kid standing where he was, and I walked past him, and I said, just stand there and don't move, right? And he's like, you know, questioning my judgment, everything. I was like, no, trust me, just stay right there and don't move. And I walked past him, and I just stood there, and all those ants came after me. They went right by him, right? They went right by him, and they came after me. I moved, and they turned to where I moved to. It was really fascinating, but this is how these things behave. You know, they get a one-track mind corporately, and they go after a target relentlessly. You know, here where I live now, in Garland, I've been here quite a few years, 6 years, something like that. And 1 year early on, I was decided to build like an extension to the fence situation around the yard. So I was building this fence, and there was one point in the day where I had, you know, it was down on the ground. I had to screw in some boards way down. I was sick of bending over, sick of squatting down. Yeah, so I was already starting to get old 5-6 years ago. It was a lot of work, you know, it's heavy duty work. Wears you out. So I just kind of sit down on the ground for all of like 5 minutes to put a couple screws in down low. And ants came up on me. They probably gave me like a good 15, 20, 25 bites on my legs. I didn't even see them. It just happened. I just, all of a sudden, later on that day, you know, I come out of my clothes, maybe take a shower after the work, and all of a sudden I'm itchy and I got all these pock marks all over my legs. And that's how it happened. That's how quick it happens. And that's how bad it gets. And I got to tell you, this itch, like, I don't, people feel the sting. People feel the burn. And these fire ants do both. You know, you get it from both sides of them. They bite you out the front and they sting you out the back. And there's a poison. There's a venom involved with it. Again, these things are very small, and the amount of venom they put into you is very small. But it's enough to really screw with your skin. You'll get a, you know, a bite mark, a single bite that swells up and turns red, maybe the size of like a pea all the way around. So it's like a pea with a dot in the middle. And the dot in the middle is where the bite happened and where the venom is sitting, right? To me, I don't feel the bite. I don't know this happened until later on when it starts to itch. And that's the part that sucks, because it's a powerful itch. It cannot be ignored, and you will scratch these things to the bone, you know, if it's anywhere near, like on your feet, right? You get a bite on your foot, like on the top of your foot, and there's just no meat there, just skin to bone. I did it. I got a big scar, big scab on my foot right now from this. I just got bit up this year here on the job. I don't know exactly where it happened. I got my ideas, but it could have been anywhere, right? There's just ant mounds all, and they're flat. They mound up when the rain hits them. There's ant holes and little ant hills everywhere. Some you can see, some you can't see. And I was doing some work out here outside, and I stepped on one of them and didn't even know I did, because the whole day went by, and I went home later, and I just started itching like crazy, and you just start seeing all these dots popping up on my leg. And I got a couple on my foot, like I was talking about, and I was using the callus on my other foot to scratch these things. And I think what happened was, when I fell asleep, I was still doing that, and I just tore the skin right down almost to bone. It's ugly, you know, it's ugly. It isn't infected or anything, but it's ugly. And these things take a long time to heal. They'll itch for 3, 4, 5 days, like crazy, like that. Like you can't sleep at night, crazy. And then when they stop itching, they just sit there on you for another month or two. They just don't heal up and go away. It takes a while. It sucks. But I'm dealing with that now. I'm way past the itch of it all. But I got marks on my legs, and they're scabbed up, and they really do not progress well in terms of healing, right? But I know how to deal with these things. A lot of people don't, you know. You go looking for different kinds of compounds and whatnot to help with this situation. Once you get bit up like that, you got this itch that won't let you sleep at night. And, you know, it got away from me this time. I forgot about it. But it's something I learned when I was dealing with the situation in New York with bed bugs, right? I was staying somewhere and they had bed bugs in the house and I was getting bit up by them. And it's a similar situation. You get these little marks on your legs, they itch like hell, right? Strangely enough, it only seems that they itch at night for whatever. I don't know why that is. Ant bites are not like that. They itch constantly all the time. But I did as much research as I could to find something to do to deal with these things. And I read somewhere, kind of like an old home remedy, was to get the borax, right? Borax powder, pour it in your bath and soak in it for a while, and it takes away the itch. And before I remembered that this time around, I sent my wife on a mission to the store to just find. You would think, living in Texas and having fire ants all over the place, somebody would have come up with some kind of ointment or cream or something like that, spray to put on fire ant bites and knock that itch off. She could find nothing that was dedicated to that. Chiggers out here, you got dedicated solution for that. Then you got just general itch stuff, cortisone creams and all kinds of sprays and stuff. And she bought me like one of everything, two of some things, you know. And none of it worked. None of it worked. And I was just racking my brains in this pain of all this itch going on that just would not relent. And I remembered about the bed bug stuff, the borax, right? And it's sold now. Well, I was a little kid back, you know, in that town in Hillside, playing with the ants and everything. We had a box of Boraxo, it was called. And it's just, you know, different manufacturers draw this stuff out and sell it. It's used for a lot of different things. I'll talk about that. Now it's not Boraxo, but it's 21 Mule Team Borax, right? That's what I bought up in New York, and that's what you buy here in Texas. And every house should have at least a box of it. This stuff is great, right? What I do with it, like I started to talk about before with the whole bed bug thing, is I pour, you know, the boxes are, what, like 8.5 by 11 or so, give or take, right? It comes in like a powdered detergent type of box, old school, right? And about a third of the box you pour into the bath water, and the bath water make it scalding hot, like you can't tolerate even putting a toe in it. Let it all kind of dissolve as much as you can do it, hopefully that you, it's so, there's so much powder that it won't fully dissolve. You want it like that, like you can't see through the water. You want to have some stuff in there, right? As soon as you're able to get into the scalding water, get in it, sit down in it, like if it's on your legs, and like it usually ends up on your legs, right? Ants in the pants again, right? That's usually how it happens. I've got bites from my hips down to my toes, but nowhere else. Well, I got a couple on my forearm, actually, just one or two. But generally, all those bites happen down low. They come up from the ground, they get up to your belt line, and they really can't get past the tightness of the belt. And they'll bite everywhere on the way. And that's where I'm at, right? But you're soaking it for like 20 minutes, and while you're sitting there, you take more borax powder and pour it right onto the wounds. You know, now that you're wet, they mix with water, it comes up kind of pasty. And you just let it sit there like that, directly in each bite. It dries the skin out a lot, but it kills that itch. And you're good probably for 12 hours, maybe 12 to 15 hours, which is plenty to get you through a night's sleep at least, right? In the daytime, the itching doesn't really bother a person as much, but if you're more sensitive than I am, which most people are, you can come out, you know, take a bath around dinner time, take another bath in the morning when you get up, do the same thing. You do this over the course of about 3 days, and then the itch is finally gone on its own. But all the meanwhile, this borax is getting the job done. Now, if you don't know about borax, borax is interesting stuff. Yeah, it's an old school remedy for a lot of things, a lot of uses, right? It is a naturally occurring mineral compound, white powdery substance that dissolves in water. Right? I was talking about with the bath. It's found in evaporite deposits from dried up seasonal lakes, right? Lake beds out in the desert is what this is trying to say. Primarily in places like Death Valley, California, which is known. The whole American industry of borax comes out of the region around Death Valley, right? Death Valley is good for something because this stuff is good. And also out in Turkey, right? The nation of Turkey. common uses are cleaning, especially like laundry, right? Laundry detergent. That's what you buy it for, basically. The 21 Mule Team is a laundry detergent, but it's borax. And you can use it for all this other stuff. So cleaning in general, laundry detergent, stain removal, and it's also used in deodorizing products, right? I don't know which ones. I can't say for sure. Good chance like Arm & Hammer, which I use, probably has some of that stuff in there. That's the baking powder company that has made all these lines of all kinds of stuff. And I've used a lot of, they have detergents for laundry detergents and cleaning products and deodorant. I use these things, and I have for a long time. And there's probably a relation between baking powder, baking soda, and borax. Probably. I don't know for sure. Don't take my word for it. That's just a quick guess, you know. It's also used in glass and ceramics manufacturing. It's used as a flux in metallurgy. And it's also used in fire retardants, right? And here, the important one for this discussion, it also acts as an insecticide for ants, cockroaches, and termites, right? And what that means is, like, we get ant nests in our yard, and we have gone from using ant nest killer products that you buy at Home Depot, you know, in bags, to just getting Boraxo. Boraxo is cheap. Well, not Boraxo, but the 21 Mule Team Borax, right? I still call it Boraxo from my youth. But it's very inexpensive to buy. I mean, I can't tell you what it is right now because I don't do the shopping for the house. But, like, you know, when I needed it 10 years ago, it was like $1 a box, $1.19 a box. It really didn't cost much at all. It may be two or three times that now, but I'm telling you, when you get the itching from these bites, it's well worth it. And we've got like four or five boxes of it now in the house, and they're just going to be there. Because, well, we use them for the fire ant nests. You just go out there and pour them on, pour some water on top of it, and that's it. The nest is gone. Now, the grass won't grow there for a long time. That's the downside of it. But this stuff is not harmful as a pesticide is like to dogs and animals and stuff. It can be if they ate a whole copious amount of it. But generally, you're not using that much. It doesn't require that much. It's a pretty much a light distribution on top of your ant mound, or around where the hole is. And you'll run it in with water. Most of it goes down into the ground. Right, there's no poisons laying around, anything like that, which is scary when you got little dogs like chihuahuas and just puppies in general. If you've got little kids around that like to play in the dirt and everything, you know. But this stuff is basically generally safe in small amounts for cleaning, but it can be toxic if it's ingested in large quantities, right? I don't know exactly what a large quantity is in this case. Just don't eat this stuff, all right? Just don't eat this stuff. But it's safe on the skin, and it kills that itch. The itch, it only lasts so long, you know? Like I said, 12 to 15 hours, then you need to reapply it. But over the course of 3 days, the itch is generally gone, and it gets you through the night. You can actually sleep through the night. So, yeah, that's about all the fire ant stuff, right? Now, just moving on a completely different direction, we got a little news flash out of Arlen, Texas, right? Post-Arlen Monologics has a relation to Arlen, Texas, which is the fictitious city in the animated television series that ran from, what, 97 to 09, 13 years, 13 seasons, something like that. King of the Hill, right? Fictitious city. Arlen, Texas is modeled after Richardson, Texas, Garland, Texas, and then down in Central Texas, Temple, Texas. These are places where the creator of the show, Mike Judge, spent his youth, right? Now, Richardson and Garland are right next to each other. They're bordering towns on the north side of Dallas, north and northeast of Dallas. They're pretty much one and the same. I mean, technically, Richardson is a tech town. They got a lot of tech companies there, where Garland is like a manufacturing and factory type of town. But the neighborhoods are the same, very similar, and King of the Hill's backdrop was pretty much predicated on this general area that I'm describing right now, with some additional allusion to Temple, Texas, right, which is down by Fort Hood. It's between Waco and Austin down there. Anyway, a news flash out of Arlen, Texas. Oh, I was going to say about Arlen, Texas. What you need to know is if you put a G at the front of it and a D at the back of it, you got Garland, right? Garland. And we'll be talking about Garland, Texas as we go here. But the news flash out of Arlen, Texas is, well, there is a character in King of the Hill. His name is John Redcorn, right? Big Native American dude. A rocker, right? Big Native American rocker dude. Long flowing black hair, big open shirt, you know, muscular chest, six-pack abs, blue jeans and boots. Drives around in a Jeep, I think, and a big rocker dude. Let me give you a little bio. John Redcorn, right, as he, again, the fictitious character from King of the Hill. He's a former roadie for Winger, right? Winger was, what was Winger? They were like a Christian heavy metal band from the 80s or something like that. People like to make fun of. I don't know not one song by them, but I recall when they were doing their thing out there, Christian heavy metal was always kind of a hard concept for a lot of people to digest. There's probably ways to do it to make it work. I don't know if that band particularly managed that. But anyway, John Redcorn is a former roadie for Winger. And he's also lead singer of a fictitious band called, and I love the name of this. I don't know why. It's just funny to me. I don't know what it means or what it could mean. Big Mountain Fudge Cake, right? He's the lead singer of Big Mountain Fudge Cake. And he's also a quote-unquote licensed New Age healer, right? Bear that in mind because we're going to expand a little bit on that as I go. Also, going a lot of different ways today. John Redcorn is, as part of his New Age healing thing, he's also a masseuse. And his number one primary customer is the neighbor of Hank Hill, Nancy Hicks Gribble. Right? Hank Hill's childhood buddy and neighbor, Dale Gribble's wife, and the wife is a meteorologist / newscaster on a local, what would be a Dallas news channel, right? She's having an affair with this John Redcorn guy, and the affair lasts most of 14 years, and there was one season where it fell apart and she dedicated herself to the marriage for whatever reason, right? But through that illicit relationship, she got pregnant with John Redcorn's baby, and the baby comes out. His name is Joseph, and he looks exactly like John Redcorn. He's got that red skin, you know, the Native American skin, that very brown, reddish skin tone, and the black hair features. Looks nothing like his father, looks nothing like his mother. They're basically blonde, blue-eyed types. And the whole neighborhood could see. The whole neighborhood's aware of the relationship that John Redcorn has with Nancy Gribble. And the whole neighborhood obviously can recognize that Joseph is the son of John Redcorn as well, right? And this is an ongoing theme, a subplot throughout the King of the Hill series, right? Dale Gribble seems to be completely unaware of the fact, undeterred by the way the kid looks. It's his son as far as he's concerned, and he seems to find no reason to doubt that, but he's naive. Whatever, back to John Redcorn. Well, that's pretty much it about John Redcorn. That's a lot right there to say. Now, why do I bring him up? What's the news about John Redcorn? How do you get news out of a fictitious character? Well, you generally don't, but these fictitious animated characters are portrayed by voice actors. And now we got news about the voice actor that played John Redcorn. His name is Jonathan Joss, J-O-S-S. I should say his name was Jonathan Joss. At the age of 59, he was, about a month ago or so, shot down in San Antonio from his own house by his own neighbor. They had some kind of dispute, some kind of disagreement. It got loud. And the neighbor filled him full of lead. Pistol rounds, I don't know what caliber, but multiple gunshot wounds. Pardon me again. This voice actor, Jonathan Joss, who portrayed John Redcorn in King of the Hill, was found dead at the curbside when the cops rolled up. And that is your King of the Hill news. Now, with all these things, I gotta say, like I told you, there's a couple different ways that I'm bound to go with this series of podcast episodes as a result of just that little story right there. One of them is, you know, the surprisingly high amount of now deceased King of the Hill voice actors. You had all these characters, and they're doing now a reboot of King of the Hill, but they're missing a whole bunch of voice actors. And then I had mentioned on a very, very early episode that at least one, if not more, of the voice actors from the original run are now banned by the unions and the woke ideology from portraying their characters because they are white people and actual terra firma here portraying characters that are of some quote-unquote minority. I believe what one of them was the voice actor was a white guy who was portraying the Laotian Asian neighbor and basically loses his opportunity to continue in that work now because of the mental illness that has taken over our culture, right? Even though that mental illness is now fading away and backing off in decline and will soon be completely gone and eradicated, for whatever reason, the voice actors union actively prevents white people from portraying minorities in cartoons. I mean, literally, acting means acting. What does it even matter? But the Idiocracy, I just say that's a Mike Judge movie, Idiocracy, right? The idiocracy that we live in and the way things are, this is what we have to contend with in this rotten world. So that's one way to go, all the dead King of the Hill voice actors. Another way to go is, I knew a guy in Georgia who was the flesh and blood living image of John Redcorn. I swear, right? This guy could have been the inspiration for Mike Judge's character on this King of the Hill cartoon. So I'm compelled to tell a story or two about that just because we're in the neighborhood. And also, you know, the fact that this voice actor got shot down in San Antonio and died on the curb when the cops pulled up. I have a real life story for that. Another one. That's a real life story, but I have a similar story to that that involved a burglary gone wrong, somebody getting shot and dying on a curb in San Antonio, right? It was an in the family sort of thing. So three directions to go with all that, right? Let's go with this one that I just mentioned first. I mean, that's a pretty quick story right here, right down in San Antonio. I had an ex one time. Again, it was the mother of the kid with the fire ant story with the planks and the PVC and the garden in the backyard up in Wiley, right, years ago. All right, that boy's mother was my ex, and her family, she was half Mexican and half some version of redneck, right? And the Mexican half of her family come from San Antonio. Most of them are still down there, right, including the mother. So we would do every other month or so road trip down to San Antonio. That was a good time. A lot of times I would stay behind because I didn't get along with the mother, with my ex, right? My ex is my ex for a reason. We didn't get along. So I'd rather just stay home, and my excuse was somebody's got to watch the dogs, right? When we had dogs in the house, I'll stay and watch the dogs. Y'all go and y'all go. But I did go a lot of times also, nonetheless. I did like to go down there and hang out, be there. I liked the area. I liked the area around San Antonio. In fact, when I came to Texas, that's where I was heading to, but I just never really made it there. Came close, but never really made it there. And I mean, in terms of living, in terms of visiting, yes, I've made it there, but in terms of living there, it didn't happen. So she had family down there, and her family involved, you know, had her mother, like I said, but the mother also had a couple of sisters that lived down there. One of the sisters had a couple of daughters, and one of the daughters was married to this other guy. They were both Mexican, but they're American, Mexican, like, you know, Mexican-American. They're not like, what do they call wetbacks, you know, over the river. It wasn't that kind. These were generations and generations of people with a Mexican background, but had been in Texas for a very long time. Authentic Texans, right? As far as I'm concerned, anyway. You know, they're a great couple. The guy was cool. He was into guns and everything like that. And thankfully he was, because one night, some idiot was trying to climb in the window of their house down here in San Antonio. And an alarm got set off, or a dog started barking or something, and the guy wakes up and he goes in his closet and he grabs his 12 gauge and he walks down the hall. He hears some more rattling around. He opens the door, flips on a light. There's some knucklehead standing in the window, right? One leg in, one leg out, that sort of thing, trying to break into the house. And now he's looking down the barrel of a 12-gauge with a very pissed off homeowner, pissed off husband who's got to protect everything. And the guy aimed and pulled the trigger. He gut shot the dude, right? Blew him right back out the window. He goes flying back out onto the lawn. And he tries to scamper on his hands and knees, clawing at the grass. And he made it as far as the curb on the street, right? Made it as far as the curb on the street and laid there and died. And the cops pulled up. They wrote up a little police report. And that was the end of that. Because the dude was well in his rights to do what he did. It wasn't a murder or anything like that. It was evident exactly what had happened. Burglary gone wrong. And in Texas, you got the right to do that. To defend your house unto the death. And it's that kind of story that makes me think how great Texas is, because it's different in New Jersey where I grew up. You do something like that, you're spending a minimum of 5 years in jail. You will be the one who's at fault for having had killed somebody. They're just innocent burglars coming into your house. It's a whole different mentality, right? They say liberalism is a mental illness. You favor the bad guy. You favor the evil of the world. And I grew up in that kind of attitude and that kind of culture. And that doesn't make sense. Whereas this stuff in Texas and in the South in general makes way more sense to me. That being said, you know, how cool Texas may have been, it might not be so much anymore. Now, I'm not talking about where it comes to like your Second Amendment gun rights and protecting your house and castle doctrine and all this kind of stuff. That stuff is still in place and that stuff is still good. Right? We're okay. We're okay there. But there's so many other things about Texas that was just always so much cooler about other places that you would live in this world. And I feel I'm starting to erode away with all this urban sprawl and all the migration. I'm part of the migration in here, but I don't consider myself part of the problem because I've done everything and then some to assimilate to culture here, right? And I'm more Texan than most Texans are. I'm more cowboy than most Texans are because I made a point of it. I'm not going to a place to try to teach everybody how things are done up north. Nobody wants that shit. You know, that's how I failed in Georgia. When I went to Georgia, it was culture shock. I went straight from being a damn Yankee outside of New York City down to Georgia. And I was always arguing with people down there. I thought everything they did was backwards and upside down. And this is the way we did things back up there. And nobody wanted to hear that from me. I was having a hard time making friends, rightly so. I still made friends anyway, thankfully, but they're better people than I was. I was a douche. Not this time. Coming out to Texas, I did not play it that way at all. I came out here and meant to become a Texan. Whatever that took, right? Whatever that took. And I really did like the place as it was, but so many people have come in here now for work because this is the economic boom of America. This is where everybody wants to be. So many people are fleeing other states, but they're also fleeing other nations. They're coming from all over the place. So what we got is this massive dump of every kind of immigrant, and it's come so much like New Jersey was in terms of just a cultural mishmash. It's difficult. It's just to drive anywhere. You know, there's a lot of cars. I've been in, you know, Atlanta, Georgia, like I was mentioning, way worse in terms of traffic. Of course, North Jersey, New York City goes without saying how terrible it is up there to try to get around. It's not really that bad here in terms of volume. I mean, at rush hour, it sucks if you got to work like downtown Dallas and come back out to the suburbs at the end of the day. That sucks. But there are still places that you can go and not sit in crazy, crazy traffic like that. But, you know, I say crazy, crazy traffic. Really, I said that in terms of volume. But now let me say in terms of attitude and know-how, like driver capability, it is very crazy. It is insane. Because you got so many people from so many places. I give the example when I talk about this sort of stuff. What I learned about Asian Indians, right? East Indians, or what we call the dothead Indian types, right? They have the dot on the head. The Hindus, right? The Hindu type. My understanding out there is like they have cars, but they don't really have rules of the road. Their road systems, their roadways are basically like a parking lot would be here. You just do whatever. You ride left, you ride right, you ride backwards, forwards, you cross diagonally. There is no like general rules of the road to go by. It's just all chaos. And then people like that come here where there's a lot of rules in the road, and half of them are unspoken. It's just common, what we would call common sense, right? How to handle a four-way stop, for example, right? You drive up to a four-way stop, who has the right of way, things like that. There's not a rule to it. If it's not your turn to go and you go, it's not like a cop is going to sit there and write a ticket for you. There's the stay right, pass left rule of the road. Right? That's not law. Well, in New Jersey, it actually is. A cop will pull you over for camping out in the left lane because he wants to go through there at 120 unimpeded. And rightfully so. It's for emergency vehicles generally. And we get the right as citizens to just drop in there to get around somebody who's going too slow in front of us. Sometimes you got to get somewhere in a hurry, right? I know there's a lot of people that don't like that. A lot of people think that everybody should just drive slow and that the people who are driving fast are causing all the problems. Not so. The fact of the matter is everybody in this world has their pace that they need to go at. And sometimes a slow person needs to go fast. Sometimes a fast person needs to go slow. It's not like categorizing a person as fast or as slow. It's what the situation is. And the reality is that you have some people who are going fast and you have some people who are going slow. So how do you deal with that reality? Slow people stay off to the right, fast people stay off to the left. And everybody gets to do what they're doing. Traffic moves accordingly. It's proper, right? Most places, that's not law. It's just an unspoken rule. But if you're coming, if you've grown up driving in a place like India, or really anywhere else in the world, now, England, they drive on the complete opposite side of the road. So everything is opposite in what you do. There's so much similarity, but everything left is right and everything right is left, you know, and that takes an adjustment if you're coming from there. So now you got the way people drive in England, the way people drive in India. You've got rules, you got unspoken rules, you got laws, things like that. And everybody's on a different page. So it's kind of bedlam. Every time I see like three cars together in one area, I start to get a little the ants in the pants feeling, right? Get a little anxious. Got to put your head on a swivel. It's kind of crazy like that. So it's just becoming that way in Texas. And when things start to come that way, you start to have problems related to that. And when you get problems related to that, right? Problems related to what? Multiculturalism and overpopulation, it starts to require an equal dose of regulation, right? So the more people you get, the more regulation you get. The more regulation you get, the more stupid life becomes. You start losing personal freedoms, you know? And you lose that sense of independence. And that's an American thing, right? I talked about assimilation. You're coming over to America, especially Texas. You're entering a place where people have a very powerful sense of independence in their spirits. And it's so common that it goes without saying. It's unspoken. We don't even realize how strong that sense is until people start taking it away from us. Then we start to buck up. The hair stands up in the back of the neck, and we're ready to fight. And that's how we are. That's what it is to be American, and it's even more so as a Texan, right? So I feel this multiculturalism creeping up, and I grew up in that stuff, right? I love cultures. I love variation. I love to participate in other people's ways and learning different things, right? Appreciate it. I do. I genuinely do. Because, again, I grew up in that. But it creates for problems where we start to have to tack on more laws. And wherever you have urban areas and a lot of people, you tend to get more liberal ideology coming in that likes to grow the government. You grow the government by taxation and by law, right? You start to impose all kinds of stuff upon the citizenship, and that makes independent-minded and independent-spirited people buck up. And now we have strife. This is what's happening in Texas, in the cities, Dallas, Fort Worth, right, the whole DFW area, the city Austin, the city San Antonio, like I mentioned before, city Houston, and probably lesser degrees to smaller cities like El Paso and Lubbock, right? Probably not much of a problem out there in those places. But we have this triangle in the eastern and central part of, really the central part of Texas, right? From Houston to Dallas to San Antonio. It forms a triangle on the map, and everything in there is really the population base of Texas, right? And it's happening within that triangle, but it's only really happening at the particular points where you have large cities. And here we have four large cities in that triangle, really five, count Fort Worth, right? DFW. I look at DFW as one entity, but truly Fort Worth is a little while away from Dallas, and it is its own thing. Nonetheless, right? Nonetheless, Texas, I just feel, is losing that quote-unquote cool factor. You know, I've been talking about Texas and red things, Texas red things. And here's a Texas red thing. The GOP, right? The Republican Party. We call it red, right? The Democrats are the blue party. The Republicans are the red party. In Texas, we got a problem in the House of Representatives right now where you got a lot of sellouts, right? Now, in the House of Representatives in Texas and the Senate as well, right? The state government in Texas, far and away Republican. This is far away a conservative state, right? But what's happening in the House of Representatives is you got some fake Republicans, right? They got in on a Republican ticket, but what they're doing is selling themselves out, whoring themselves out to Democrats and people who support Democrats so they can get money and they can game the system in a way that they can now achieve greater positions and authority within the House of Representatives, right? They get to be on and lead committees, for example. And they get that because they'll have Democrats vote for them. You know, they'll vote outside their party and vote for a particular sold-out, corrupted Republican who will do that in exchange for probably money and certainly a particular position, right? And then what they do is that they actually vote the Democrat Party line in exchange for all this stuff. We know them collectively as RINO, R-I-N-O, Republican in name only, right? It's obviously it's happened in a tremendous way at the federal level, but it's happened here in Texas at the state level too. Democrats, progressives, liberals, they need to corrupt Texas as much as they can to try to flip it over and take over. It's going to be a horrible day when that happens because with this economic boom, you also got a housing bubble that's going on, and it will burst when you get a state government come in and start to change policy. That's just what's going to happen. The boom is going to go away, and then all these exploded housing prices are just going to destroy families. It's going to be a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. But there's some more Texas red for you right there. That's really, it's bothersome. These people need to be tarred and feathered publicly in the streets. And if they ever show up clean, they need to be tarred and feathered again and again and again until they get the point. You know, I don't understand why this is allowed to even happen in Texas. I am so far, you know, we're 5-6 hours away from Austin, something like that. 4-5 hours away from Austin here. I can't be there every day to beat the crap out of one of these idiots. Somebody's got to do something about that stuff. Sometimes this needs to be handled at the level, you know, mano a mano type, instead of letting them play their lawyer games and get away with this shit. But it is what it is for now, and it's another example of why I feel Texas disintegrating gradually, right? All right, so that's one, that was a little side jag, but that's part of the one direction I wanted to go about the whole gut shot burglar down in San Antonio, right? I live that same story that John Redbone's voice actor had just suffered, and I had two other directions I wanted to go. And I'll pick up with that in the next episode, okay?
This monologue is continued in the next episode, Chapter 00089, Texas Red, Part 2.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, Critiques and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postallen.com.